Now, as the heat wave gripping the Mediterranean continues, some
more than 100 people, 120 people have died, and hundreds more are still missing.
As temperatures have been at or above 110 degrees for 27
New threats
days.
From intense and deadly storms ripping through the middle of the country, killing at
more
least
more than 180 people have been killed due to record amounts of rain.
Right now, the temperature is about 15 degrees above the average temperature for which
another 122,000 people have been displaced.
But scientists say the extreme weather is happening more often because of human-caused climate change.
But the ultimate driving factor is human-induced climate change that causes the weather patterns that we see today.
Welcome to Heat Beyond 1.5. Your podcast exploring the pressing challenges of the climate crisis and the innovative solutions driving our response. We dive into how technology, entrepreneurship, and resilient strategies are helping us adapt to a rapidly changing world. Join us as we uncover the tools and ideas shaping our future in the face of climate uncertainty with your hosts, Nicholas Samios, Managing Partner at PT1, and David Vaudman, Managing Director at DWR Eco.
In this first episode of our podcast, Heat on Climate Adaptation, we want to lay the foundation. What is climate adaptation? Why do we need to adapt? And one of the foremost experts on climate adaptation is Henry Neufeld from the United Nations Environmental Programme. Henry is the head of Impact Assessment and Adaptation Analysis of the UNEP's Copenhagen Climate Center. And Henry is also the coordinating author of the UNEP's annual flagship report on adaptation, the Adaptation Gap Report. My name is David Vaudman.
The challenge.
Hi, Henry.
Hi, nice to meet you.
You are the head of the Impact Assessment and Adaptation Analysis at the UNEP's Copenhagen Climate Center, and you are the coordinating author also of the UNEP's annual flagship report on adaptation, the Adaptation Gap Report. So what are you actually working on?
Right. Yeah, so the Adaptation Gap Report, which we will be launching the next edition on the 7th of November, at 12 noon Central European time. The launch of the report, of course, that's one of the major things that I do. And then besides that, I focus on the assessment of adaptation policies. That is me and my team. We do lots of risk assessments and management tools. So we also provide support directly to countries with ways through which they can assess their climate risks, plan for how to remove these and reduce these risks, and then to develop policies through which they can track whether they're making progress towards these objectives of theirs. So that's mainly what we do.
Right. So many of our listeners actually will listen to this episode after this launch date. I assume that this report can be downloaded on your Copenhagen Climate Assessment Center's homepage.
The report can be downloaded from the UNEP's homepage. So not from our, you know, not from the UNEP CCC, but from UNEP's homepage. Yeah, just Google Adaptation Gap Report 2024, and then you get the link and can find all the resources there.
Great. It's so amazing to have you on the show now, because now you can actually give us an exclusive overview of what are actually the real ideas behind the concept of climate adaptation. So can you explain what actually climate adaptation is and why it's so important in today's world?
Right. So adaptation to climate change is essentially action to reduce or limit risks that occur when climate impacts happen, like when there's a storm, when there's droughts, flooding, heat waves. You know, these are climate hazards, and adaptation is the action to reduce these hazards, to deal with them. And in the IPCC, we define climate risks as addressing exposures and vulnerabilities to climate hazards. That is, by reducing exposure, by reducing vulnerability to climate hazards, we are reducing climate risk and the actions by which we do that, reducing exposure, reducing vulnerability, that is adaptation.
So obviously we hear a lot about cutting carbon emissions as a way to fight climate change. Why isn't mitigation enough in this world? And why do we actually need to focus on adaptation now? And is there a new sense of urgency we need to have as inhabitants of this planet?
Sure, yes. Of course, mitigation is the foremost and most urgent action to reduce climate change, because the longer we wait with mitigation and reducing the emissions or removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, the higher temperatures will rise in the future. And let's be clear, the emissions that we're emitting today will be felt in 20 years' time. So what we're experiencing in terms of climate change today is essentially what we emitted around 20 years ago. That's because of the inertia of the climate system we live in. And we are already experiencing very strong climate effects. We're close to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That's at the global average. And you can see that even at this early stage, climate impacts are strong. And very importantly, therefore, we must reduce the impacts that are current and then also future climate impacts will have on us to reduce losses and damages. If we don't act, losses and damages due to climate impacts will be very, very high. And adaptation can reduce the costs of these impacts, the losses to life, to biodiversity, to the availability of people to have a future for their homes, you know, when they might have to migrate because their island is flooded in the future. These things will be getting much, much worse. And the costs of adaptation will also rise extremely, you know, much stronger than what we have to put up now in terms of mitigation to reduce these impacts. So adaptation is essentially the way by which we can reduce the damages and the losses that missed opportunities in mitigation require.
Right. And do you see a certain risk that, considering that there are still strong, influential stakeholders out there who either don't accept the fact of climate change or who are actively working against any climate change mitigation policies because they have some vested interest, for example, still burning fossil oil, etc. So do you see a certain risk that these stakeholders could use the climate adaptation strategies and push this as a policy agenda in order to say, well, let's just adapt to climate change. It's maybe just a lot cheaper to do that instead of fighting climate change.
I mean, it's in the short term, it may be cheaper. In the long term, it is much, much more expensive. And I think you have to think about the climate crisis as a generational or intergenerational problem. Basically, by avoiding to strongly mitigate climate change, we are depriving our children, their children, of a future to thrive, to live sustainably and develop their full potential. I'm very concerned about the fact that by not investing in the mitigation of climate change, we are creating an environment for future generations that is essentially unlivable. In many places, it will be unlivable. In some places, it will be better at the beginning, but the longer we wait, the worse it will get. So anybody who claims that this is a cheaper solution will have to answer to their children how that can, their future's damages can be cheaper. You know, that's just morally bankrupt.
Yeah, probably just not morally, but also economically, because at the end of the day, probably nobody can bear these costs if they become even higher and higher.
They're much, much higher, and they will continue. It's like you'll have upfront costs for mitigation. You have high costs upfront, and then you reap the benefits forever. For adaptation, you will pay more and more the longer you wait with reducing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. Ultimately, there is no other way. You cannot continue emitting greenhouse gases. It's just not feasible.
Right. Do you already sometimes feel that your cause, your agenda is being misused by some of these stakeholders I've mentioned, that they just say, well, let's just adapt to climate change instead of doing too much into mitigation?
No, that's not what we hear. I mean, even stakeholders, countries that support or want to enhance fossil fuel production say that mitigation is necessary, but they have longer timelines and they argue that their development needs to be addressed as well. And this is an issue that reflects on the requirement for the global north, which has benefited from decades, if not centuries, of development versus developing countries that have not had that opportunity to also develop their economies. So the onus of action is with the big emitters today, which are the industrial countries of the global north. They have to do most of the heavy lifting. I'm not saying that there aren't a few countries that are not among those considered the Annex One countries, those that are obliged by the UNFCCC to support developing countries in their ambitions to remove emissions or reduce emissions and also to adapt to climate change. But there are ways for the global north to support developing countries to overcome this step to develop with fossil fuels. You know, renewable energies are already cheaper than fossil fuels.
Yes. So just to follow up on your last remarks, in which fields do you see very specific climate impacts coming up over the next, let's say, 10 to 20 years?
So we are already experiencing a lot of climate impacts. And I already mentioned the hazards. You know, it's heat waves, flooding. We're seeing flooding right now in Spain. You know, this is definitely affected by climate change. You know, flooding is a normal process, but climate change has amplified the number and intensity of these climate hazards manifold. We now have ways to attribute climate change, the proportion of climate change, or the probability by which climate change is contributing to certain hazards. And very often we can assess that without climate change, these hazards most likely wouldn't have happened in a way that they have. You know, that's very often the case. And so we have heat waves, we have flooding, we have increased droughts and storms, you know, in coastal zones, but also in other places. And then there are slow onset climate impacts like sea level rise, which we know is happening. And that is leading to the loss of land where people live in coastal zones. And then, you know, like groundwaters are salinified. And that means that people depending on agriculture in coastal zones will not have any more ability to do so because their soils are just too saline. So there are many, many ways through which these hazards appear.
And even wildfires and also cold.
I forgot wildfires, spells, yes.
Right?
Wildfires.
Cold spells as well. So we are actually not we are not talking about only heating up of the planet and global warming, but it's really this extreme weather changes from one to the other extreme.
Yes, yes. Sometimes there's cold spells as well. These become more erratic and they can emerge. Yes, that's happened too. Yes.
Right. So climate impact doesn't affect everyone equally, right? So can you explain how social, economic, and geographic factors shape the vulnerability to climate change?
Yes, of course. So all things being equal, you know, everybody is exposed to climate hazards. We all are. We live in places, and then there's, you know, like in Spain, for instance, or in Germany a couple of years ago, there was this massive flooding. There's been heat waves in Europe. But when these things happen in countries that are poor, that have less capacity, where people are more vulnerable to or sensitive to these hazards, the effects become much, much bigger. So we can prepare much better. We have the resources to respond more easily. We have better access to loans even, you know. And so everything is geared to support us in the developed world. Whereas in developing countries, on top of having to face much more harsh general conditions and the enabling environment these people and countries often operate in, are much more difficult. Therefore, when climate change happens, they are much more exposed, they are much more vulnerable, and then they face higher losses and damages because of that proportionally. And then, of course, then there are places in the world where climate change happens faster than other places. And just by rule of thumb, you know, the Arctic, the high latitudes, also the high altitudes, experience much faster warming than other areas, in particular ocean areas, you know, coastal zones that are, you know, where there's some kind of buffering due to the buffering effects of the ocean, of the sea. And high level, high latitude, high altitude regions have to adapt much, much faster, but they don't have the capacity to do so very often.
So if we talk about all these consequences for certain social groups, can you also pin down in what regions climate adaptation actually happens? And what are these regions for the most need of adaptation?
I think the countries of the global south in particular are in need of more adaptation, even more adaptation than the global north. Right. At the same time, you know, everybody is exposed to, I just mentioned it, everybody is exposed to climate hazards. And when climate impacts hit, we all suffer. The costs, the damages, the losses are tremendous. But if these impacts hit in developing countries, the damages, particularly to life, loss of life, very often are much higher, you know, because the infrastructure isn't there. There's lack of capacity to respond. There's lack of technology to manage climate risks. And very often in many developing countries, there isn't even early warning system or systematic climate observation. So their ability to plan for coming impacts is limited. And one of the UN's goals is to have systematic observation and climate information systems, early warning systems for all by 2027. That's very difficult to achieve, and it requires massive investment in these early warning systems. So
yes,
it is necessary for the global north to support much more strongly developing countries.
Yeah. So talking about financing, the latest adaptation report has highlighted that there's a huge adaptation finance gap. So the report estimates it is between 194 billion and $366 billion US dollars per year for developing countries. So this is 10 to 18 times larger than the current public adaptation finance thing in general. So how do you look at this financing gap, and how do we close it, actually?
Yeah, that's a question that will be discussed very extensively during COP in Baku in just 2 weeks' time. So this is among the most critical questions to answer. How do you increase finance in adaptation, given that the gap is so wide? I mean, the gap is, as you said, is enormous, and there is limited appetite to enhance finance, international adaptation finance. But, you know, there's the plea to invest in adaptation finance, because ultimately it benefits all. If we do not adapt, the damages and the costs that ultimately emerge will be much higher than investing in adaptation. So it's a good investment. In all senses, you know, there are the cost to benefit to cost ratio is typically 4 to 1, can go up to 10 to 1 in some areas. So it's a good investment to adapt. You know, of course, mitigation, you know, that's on the side. But investing in adaptation is a good investment compared to not investing in adaptation. So increasing adaptation finance is really quite important. Now, there are several ways by which to do that. First, international public finance needs to be increased, you know.
Right.
That's the developed countries, the donors, the international development banks, and multilateral development banks. They need to increase their investments, and ultimately they depend on funding from the donors in the global north. The domestic adaptation also needs to, or will be, increasing. Countries will also invest more strongly in their own adaptation. And then lastly, the private sector needs to come into the fore much more strongly than it currently does. But we have very limited data on the amount of adaptation finance from the private sector. So that's the problem. Let me just add one point, which I think is really important. A reform of the international financial infrastructure is quite relevant in order to improve access to funding for developing countries in need of additional support. You know, when there is a major impact, like in Pakistan 2022, for instance, the flooding, it costs, you know, like in the range of 20% to 30% of the GDP. That's enormous. And if countries then fall deeper into debt, they are even less likely to emerge out of these problems. So in addition to the direct costs, the damages, the losses, in addition to those, there is an increase in debt and the lack of ability to then climb out, as it were, of this debt hole that they are already in. So a reform of the international climate financial infrastructure is quite important to enhance access to loans and finance and to reduce the needs to pay for debts, you know, interest.
Yeah, and a lot of has been, as you indicated already, by public funding or needs to be covered by public funding, which is basically taxpayers' money, right? So it depends on the ability of the economy in general to raise this taxpayer money to root this into climate adaptation. You mentioned activating private money. Do you see even business models out there or certain ways of remuneration of, let's say, climate adaptation technologies or measurements where there is, and this really shouldn't, you know, be, you know, sarcastic, you know, but is there actually a market out there for climate adaptation measurements and technologies?
Certainly, there are sectors that lend themselves to private sector investment. And when it comes to, you know, the distribution of certain technologies that help reduce climate risks, that is, and adapt. And often they're not even branded as adaptation. They would just be certain technologies. Of course, you know, that's an area where the private sector can directly invest very easily because there is a profit to be made. You know, so where the private sector needs to make a profit, otherwise they will not invest. So where there is an opportunity for returns on investment, that's an area where the private sector can and already is investing in adaptation. Very often, however, it requires for these benefits to be accessible to the private sector, the certain risks must be overcome, and de-risking investments through blended finance, that is, you know, public-private partnerships, is also important. And lastly, then there are areas where the private sector simply cannot or will not invest because the returns on investment are not there. And this is unfortunately very often the case in adaptation that is more transformational, that addresses underlying problems that are typically part of the public sector, you know, like health or infrastructure. And here, the public sector is really called upon. So yes, the private sector can take a stronger role, but on the other hand, there are limitations for the private sector to invest in certain areas because of the risks of investing, or perceived risks at least. And then a last point I'd like to make is that through legislation, the private sector can be obliged to disclose their climate risks in certain sectors, and that will automatically trigger stronger perception and investment to reduce these risks, because that would undercut their bottom line.
Okay. So what other policy measures you see, apart from the one you just mentioned, which could be key or maybe a low-hanging fruit to make progress in advancing climate adaptation?
Yes. So planning for adaptation is really a good thing. It pays off. So health adaptation plans, for instance, they have very, very high returns and provide a lot of co-benefits, you know, with with regard to reducing the exposure of vulnerable populations to floods, to droughts, etc. You know, and these are ultimately pretty cheap things, but you need to plan for them. Otherwise, when something happens, you're not prepared. And then adaptation. So planning for adaptation through national adaptation plans or sectoral adaptation plans, that is fundamentally important. It's happening. And I think it can be improved. Certain legislation to mandate assessing progress towards adaptation goals, national goals or sectoral goals, is also very important. So this is something that governments can do, or rather legislation can do, to oblige governments to disclose their progress. And that is a way to enhance accountability and transparency in actions. So here's a direct policy incentive. I already mentioned early warning systems and systematic climate observation. Where that is not available, that also reduces exposure considerably and is really important. So there are just a few things that you can do quite easily to reduce your existing risks.
And probably in general, if we look at the EU or maybe some other larger geographical areas like Africa or the Americas and Asia, etc., so we need to have, maybe even from the UN as well, some discussions and input started that at the national level, these adaptation strategies are being implemented. But that at the national level, those, let's say, planning approaches are being put into legislation, but the actual implementation very often then happens on a local level, right?
Well, the implementation has to happen at the local level. That's where climate impacts hit.
Right.
And I would say that is also one of the big challenges with adaptation versus mitigation. You know, mitigation often has more to do with investment in technologies. They are localized. They provide benefits globally. Whereas adaptation requires local action, and where there is limited capacity at the local level, then the impacts hit harder. So connecting vertically between the national level and the local level through subnational legislation and policies and capacity building, technology transfer is really quite important. And one of the problems we face with adaptation, you know, this disconnect between national planning, local implementation. And for that reason, monitoring and evaluation and learning from experience are so fundamentally important to improving the responses that we have to climate impacts. And I have to say just one more thing. Current adaptation practice is really quite poor. I mean, 2 years ago in the Adaptation Gap Report, we identified the effectiveness of adaptation, and we had to conclude that the practices are poor because local stakeholders are not involved adequately. They need to be co-owners, co-planning. They need to be partners in the development. There's a short-term focus. There's a focus on incremental versus transformational adaptation. And then there's also poor tracking of outcomes. So, you know, if you plan for current impacts, you may be missing the fact that in a few years, these impacts will have grown significantly. And if your sector is longer term, then investments in these sectors will have been done without considering future climate risks. So, you know, you need to be really aware of what you're doing and how you're doing things to have better adaptation outcomes.
Mm-hmm. So, coming to an end, we talked about climate adaptation, what kind of impacts are there geographically, broadly as well, what kind of impacts we are expecting. We talked about the certain stakeholder groups which are being hit most than others, talked about financing legislation. We briefly also touched already on the private sector, but Maybe to end, what kind of role do you see which businesses, investors, those who are actually driving our societies these days in so many other ways, what kind of role can the private and the business sector can take over in order to play a good role in climate adaptation?
I think there is a role for the private sector to address adaptation. First and foremost, of course, in climate proofing their own investments against the future. That's something that's fundamentally necessary and isn't happening to the degree necessary. And for this reason, I think legislation, public sector legislation, mandating this kind of disclosure is quite important. And at the international level, it creates a pressure on private sector to be more forthcoming in disclosing their own climate risks. Then evidently, where there are business opportunities, the private sector can contribute most strongly to reducing the risks of those of their customers to climate risks, all sorts of climate risks in infrastructure and housing, to build in ways that allow to reduce the need for air conditioning that has benefits, you know, making greener cities, because that has benefits not only for adaptation and livelihoods and well-being, but also for mitigation. So I think the private sector has a very big role to play in adaptation. And lastly, I think maybe there's also an opportunity for future businesses to invest more strongly in sort of providing these services to the general public, you know, how to plan, how to implement adaptation at local levels, you know, like consultancies, they can do that. So there are ways through which the private sector can strongly contribute to adaptation. But as I said, the public sector will remain very, very important. It's the driver of the more transformational change. And the needs here are for the public sector to create the enabling conditions for private sector to invest more strongly.
Yes. I actually have one more last question. Now, we are recording this podcast before the next UN climate conference in Baku. And obviously, there might be a lot of listeners who might listen into this episode after the climate conference has happened. Still, what is the best output you think we would see after this UN climate conference? Do you think whatever you imagine today, what's the best outcome in terms of climate adaptation as well here? Is it still good enough of what we need?
I can't make any projections of that sort. My hope is that the negotiations in Baku lead to a strong new collective quantified goal on climate finance. That is on the agenda this year. It's to be addressed. And the idea is that this goal be connected to the needs in developing countries in particular. You know, this goal is designed to support developing countries in addressing and adapting more strongly, but also to invest more strongly in mitigation. So it's not only adaptation, it's both. In that sense, a strong new financial goal, setting a strong and ambitious goal, is really the most important outcome for this coming COP, I would say.
Henry Neufeld, thank you so much for this very, very deep insight into this topic. We probably hear a lot more about you. Thank you so much for contributing to this episode. Talk to you hopefully someday later.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
The Fix.
So our journey through the growing ecosystem of climate change adaptation technology starts with the obvious first subsector, data. Because if we don't gather tons of unbiased, scientifically backed data sets in our hands and build the smart tools that help us to make sense out of it and therefore support risk or investment decisions, we won't be able to navigate the increasingly difficult world climate change creates. I'm therefore very happy to welcome Kamil Kluser to this session. Kamil is co-founder and CEO of London and New York City-based climate risk data analytics expert ClimateX. Before co-founding ClimateX, Kamil was a risk specialist at Accenture and a couple of large financial institutions. So distilling out wisdom from piles of data is likely a core part of his DNA. ClimateX also seems to be a really great company. I'm a bit biased as my venture fund PT1 is also a happy shareholder. But recently Google Ventures took the lead in a substantial Series A financing round to support the international rollout. So Camille, great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Nicolas. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, but in your own words, of course, because I think that will be much more sophisticated than what I just said. So what is ClimateX exactly doing, and also maybe why you choose that very topic when you founded the company some years ago?
So ClimateX are a global climate risk and data analytics platform. We build SaaS and we service fairly niche but yet very complicated industries such as financial services and asset management. Now, what we do provide to them is a number of solutions that come out of a platform, and they serve the upstream, midstream, and downstream physical climate risk data needs. Just like in the, in banks or insurance, you'd have operational risk, market risk, credit risk. Climate risk just became its own domain, and the firms are integrating that into the DNA all the way from the top, so starting at strategy, all the way through down to the originations and how they acquire new business. So the problem, whilst looks simple on the face of it, is actually multifaceted. It impacts a number of firms and a number of teams along one single organization. As to the rationale, why my co-founder Lucky and I decided to set up ClimateX, I guess both of us had slightly different drivers, but we definitely aligned on one. We saw what was at one point available on the market, and we definitely thought that we could do better because the lack of really good data and insights, so not just the measure, but also how you act upon it, was simply lacking. The there's the number of standards that the financial services need to sort of follow, including model risk management or data risk management and so on. And that necessarily wasn't reflected in the market at the time. In addition, myself, like, I definitely wanted to challenge and do not as something within an impact, but I definitely wanted to have a meaningful impact. And quite frankly, I was tired of a corporate job as well. So here's the key drivers for setting up ClimateX.
Excellent. So if we try to kind of distill out some aspects here. So you mentioned financial service industry multiple times, right? So of course, these guys need to make clever decisions because they potentially manage third people's money or something. So is their motivation now to have a closer look on climate risk and how the world is changing? Is that now driven by, let's say, a regulator, for example, just requiring it? Or is it driven by kind of, let's say, a prudent business decision so that as entrepreneurs, if you want to say so, they make better bets on the future?
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. So I would clarify or specify the use cases within financial services into two very simple buckets. One is the front book and one is the back book. What I mean by that, front book is anything to do with new business, new lending, new acquisition, new investments, anything that has been added to the assets or the liability pile of a given financial services firm. Now, the motivations here are very different than for the back book. It's very much about risks, but also opportunities. It's about your investments and whether they survive for another 10 years because of some cataclysmic storms might happen or not. It's about also working out well to strategically place your portfolios, diversify, and effectively enact the strategy. The back book on the other side, this is where we have seen quite a few of regulatory tailwinds. And this is how the strategy is being set up, how the banks are making prudent decisions, how the banks impact the pricing of the front line. So those two things are very closely interconnected. And this is potentially an activity that is part driven by the business itself, coming all the way through the board, but also by the regulators. Now, playing on the regulatory aspects alone can be a double-edged sword. Obviously, we know what's currently happening in the US. There's elections coming up. Subject to whomever might become a president might also impact the global market and how the regulation is shaping up. So in terms of how we operate, we definitely diversify. But we see the needs of both sides of the organization, front and the back.
Right. Maybe because not all the listeners are so deep into kind of financial service industries and what the driving factors are. Is there like a easy example you could do, like, I don't know, like a new development of a piece of real estate that's on the shoreline somewhere and therefore potentially has climate risk elements that would be interesting to assess? So, like a simple example you could do?
Yeah, 100%. So think about an asset manager. The asset manager wants to set a strategy. For example, we want to churn 20% of our portfolio within the next 10 years, but we want to do it in a sustainable way, i.e. Acquire for hold and then resell only specific types of assets that potentially are unimpacted by climate change. So that requires the back book work I was referring to earlier. They want to work through strategy, valuations, geographical geolocation of the assets they want to potentially acquire. They run through multiple scenarios. They're trying to stress test the assumptions. They'll come up with the recommendations, potential pricing, and that work is nearly complete. I mean, some of the firms are also under regulatory obligations in order to disclose what they've done and how they're doing it. Now, there's a second part, which is more commercial. Once they build that strategy, and for example, they want to buy 15 offices next year within the European, within European capitals, but they all need to be climate risk free. So that strategy is then later being enabled by the front line, the actual folks that do due diligence and the originations themselves. So as part of the due diligence process, there's an investment committee, and as part of that investment committee, new deals are being scrutinized and looked at from that physical risk perspective. If you then translate it, for example, from asset management to a mortgage, it's a simple retail mortgage bank, they do exactly the same, just thousands times more per month, because they literally do exactly the same process, but they issue in mortgages just to regular citizens, just like you and I.
Okay, understood. And then maybe now zooming in of kind of on what data are your recommendations, your engine, what is like the input, yeah, where are you starting? And then kind of, I don't know how you can disclose that if you want to, right? But what is the secret sauce? What is the special thing about your solution?
I think the first point about our solutions that solves the customer pain point, and there's multiple, but the first and foremost is that identify and measure the risks and opportunities. Now, how you tie it to the data, there's a lot of data out there, better with quality, but in order to do our own modeling, and we model 12 different hazards that are CSRD, which is a climate risk policy aligned, we do that across the globe, and we do that at the high resolution. Now, in order to get there, and in order to calculate the final financial impacts on these assets that we've just discussed, one needs to have, as you rightly pointed, quite a lot of data. I think we probably have up to 200 very varied different data sources. It's predominantly remote sensing. So it's a different type of apparatus, such as optical, there's radio, we use laser. We work with both NASA, ESA, European Space Agency, but we also work with private satellite providers. There's certain areas that we probably want to scrutinize a bit better, and this is where we get the data from. Then that's the kind of what's on the earth, and, you know, what we call the byproduct of this data that's collected as a digital twin of the earth. So we're basically trying to figure out what's the topography, where's the water reservoirs, where's the infrastructure, and so on. We then overlay that data with the built environment. So we've got roughly 1.5 billion assets that have been mapped, not just from the perspective of this is an asset, this is a home, this is a hotel, but we also have now added additional asset classes such as manufacturing, mining, industry, and so on and so forth. So we're now able to say how big these assets are, how old they are, and basically how vulnerable those physical climate risk they are, so that we can calculate the financial impact both from revenue, from operational perspective, as well as from the damage perspective. Now, in order to get the data, we synthesize some of the customer data. We also use some of the open sources, because there's a couple of global projects, but we also purchase some of this data ourselves. The trick here is our own modeling. We use anything from neural nets through to machine learning, through to GRI, such as large language models. And basically, we strongly believe in developing technology or using technology that is best suited for a given problem. Now that you've got your globe and you've got your asset library, I'm forgetting the very important point as well about modeling of the hazards. So all of the tropical cyclones, all of the river surface, storm surge flooding and so on, this is our own in-house models. Now, what it allows us is to provide comfort to our end customers that we own the full lineage in terms of the data sourcing, the algorithms that we produce in order to generate the hazards and the likelihood losses, so that they can have full control and sort of not full control, but full confidence and trust in the numbers they get in to use for their own business decision.
Okay, and now if you look into the future, are you then assuming certain climate change scenarios kind of yourself out of the box, or are you just giving your customers the possibility to simulate different scenarios where they choose kind of the warming, for example, 10, 20 years down the road?
So we currently operate within a space of 8 scenarios. Personally, I do believe it's too many because the users typically tend to opt for 2 or 3 of those, just depending on the use case in a specific customer. The scenarios themselves, they established by international bodies. The final body that governs those is called Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And these are the folks that basically say, with this 3-degree warmings, then we're probably looking at something called SSP or RCP 8.5. Now, these scenarios, what they give you is simply the amount of rainfall temperature within a different sort of temporal variance and spatial as well. Now, that in itself sounds fairly easy, but the thing is that all those things are interconnected and most of the modeling is deterministic, so it doesn't rely on the past to predict the future. Therefore, we tend to advise the customers not to play with the scenarios themselves because we've got abundance of those. And quite frankly, the assumptions they might be making might not be entirely correct. So one of the consensus, I think, taken by financial services, governments and regulators was to actually default to these scenarios, but look at the different variants and combinations to actually derive something that is value add for the business. We've had quite a bit of fun with that. The scientific world sometimes tends to be a little detached from the commercial world, but I think that's why you get firms like ourselves that kind of can speak both languages and sort of bridge the gap between practicality and science.
Right. So you are a fast-growing startup, right? So I think that's fair to say. So there are more and more customers using your solution to, let's say, have a better radar into the future and also to analyze existing assets and then make more clever decisions like you explained, changing the strategy of an existing portfolio, stuff like that. But is it fair to say that over the last couple of years, still, let's say, too little business decisions have been made factoring in these climate change risks? So I just give you a simple example again. So I'm just looking at a part of the harbor in Copenhagen. And pretty much every year you visit the city, there it has been a new development very close to the sea. So my question, very simplified, naive question potentially, is have they all factored in the risks that are coming from that location? Is that already the status quo? Or is it just starting and will there be like a big wave of bad surprises potentially over the next couple of years when pretty much everybody uses a sophisticated tool like your solution?
That's a very good question. I'm going to try to answer very politically. It depends.
Yeah.
So there are firms that definitely believe that climate change is real and they already put measures in place regardless of the policy and regulation whatsoever. They also see this as a business opportunity to an extent. If you have 2 properties, 2 amazing offices, but you know that one of these will be flooded in the future and the other one not, then obviously you'll make a sound decision by going for the one that will not get impacted. However, not everybody's looking at that in the same way. Admittedly, there has been a lot of regulatory fragmentation that we've seen on the market. So we've seen the different financial regulators, and there are probably five that really matter in the world. That is the PRA in the UK, ECB, which covers Europe, Fed in America, and we've got in Asia, HKMA and MAS. They started slightly diverging from the mainstream or from aligning in terms of the expectations of financial services specifically. What that causes, I think, is a little bit fatigue by both the larger and smaller banks alike. So I think that there's a bit of a double-edged sword in terms of making firms doing too much that isn't necessarily value add. So I think where the banks are, particularly in insurance, on that journey is that they started with the, if you recall from earlier this conversation, from the back book. So they wanted to understand the current portfolio, where they are and so on. And those that have been made by the regulators to do so, they definitely did at various level of, you know, advancement, I would say. There's generally a move up, and I think the traditionally we've seen the Asia Pacific and Europe being a bit further ahead versus the US, but that is changing pretty fast, and US is catching up pretty fast. So to answer your question very, very briefly, yes, we've seen the growth. I think it very much depends on both the jurisdiction as well as the subsector of financial services, and finally individual country circumstances, really.
Maybe another question, maybe it's oversimplified, but I think these simple stories will help the listeners understand on what we're talking about. Think about let's say flooding events, yeah, happening pretty much everywhere, unfortunately. And think about the situation that stuff needs to be rebuilt afterwards. And my personal feeling is that in the future, it's not so much more, let's say, the local governments deciding that this has to be rebuilt here or there, but it's more or less the insurance companies kind of that will decide indirectly, because you can say 20 times, I don't believe in climate change, but sooner or later, if, I don't know, Munich Re or something doesn't do any more insurances in areas of Florida, nobody can build something. Is that simplified story, is that true or wrong from your perspective?
So I think insurance plays a key role when it comes to what we just discussed. And the thing is that insurance has been traditionally relying on something called CAT models or catastrophe models, which have been fairly, well, to say plainly, backwards looking. So they would simulate the next year's events based on the past experience. Now, that might be all fair and well, because the insurance premium and the policies you and I would take for our homes, for example, they just won, yeah. The problem is that with climate change, since it's non-linear and non-stationary, you can't actually use the past really to predict the future. You need to move into the deterministic view of the world. And that's what I think happened in Florida and California, where those insurers failed to grasp the fast nature of the climate change. And that's why a lot of the insurers had to withdraw from the market. We already know, using our own solution, the areas where properties will be uninsurable. So, for example, if on average you're looking to be scoring above 10% of a replacement cost on every single asset, that's touching on the zone of uninsurability. Hence, the next thing that will kick into the equation is climate adaptation. So, potentially, if you have a property that you will know will be impacted by climate change, but if you add some adaptation finance to it, then potentially the insurance premium will remain affordable. And I think this is the way forward, because ultimately something someone's going to have to pay. And I don't necessarily personally see governments stepping in with enhanced programs such as the one we have in Germany or UK, where basically there's a subsidized insurance when it comes to the flooding losses. So I think climate adaptation will play a key role and an interplay between the size of insurance and the potential lending for adaptation finance.
Right. So if I understand you correctly, so there are areas, what you just said, that you can calculate using the bit more sophisticated models like you have, are pretty much, let's say, red zones. So it doesn't make any sense anymore to rebuild stuff there, because it will not be economically viable, yeah, if you look at the total cost of it. But let's say there are yellow areas, to use that simplified traffic light concept, where it's possible, but you need more sophisticated tools to really assess the risk, yeah, and make the clever lending, insurance, construction, whatever decision. So therefore, softwares like yours will help to navigate there, and then potentially also to help us, let's say, as societies, if you zoom out a bit, to avoid barking up the wrong tree in a way, because there is a harsh reality that some areas just might not make sense anymore to rebuild stuff like it has been before after a hurricane, flooding, or whatever event. Is that true?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we've developed alongside our flagship platform, Spectra, we developed a solution called ADAPT. It's an ISO-compliant set of adaptation measures, both direct and indirect, that a user can choose and select to sort of mitigate or circumvent some of the damages that might be happened from climate. So as an example, there's a property that might experience two different types of flooding, say an office, and it might be impacted by surface flood, a very typical city flood. The whole of Europe, US, will be suffering from it. There's also an exposure to the river flood. Now, what the user can do is then they can select to look at the direct adaptation measures. So this is something that an asset owner can pay for themselves. So they can look at sort of self-made mini flood defenses. They can look at drainage around the property. That's something they can potentially finance themselves. On the other side, this large-scale council government land sort of projects, such as the massive flood defense projects along the rivers that obviously a given asset owner wouldn't be able to finance themselves. So our solution would effectively combine those two and pretty much spit out a capex and an ROI on that particular adaptation, so that you can make sure you can future-proof that side asset. It.
Maybe if I can ask a personal question for a minute. So
sure.
You're talking about all these data scenarios and risk and stuff that's happening, and I think that sometimes, yeah, if you really understand what's going on, it can be personally a bit frightening, right? Because you have a very clear view into the future. So on a personal level, are you kind of afraid of the next decades, or are you, let's say, very relaxed and convinced because you think that we as societies, yeah, will find a way through and adapt?
That's a very deep philosophical question, Nicholas.
It is.
I believe human species is very resilient. I think more and more warning shots will be coming out of our own planet Earth, so that people will bit by bit and gradually start realizing that climate change will impact not only their livelihoods, but also their wallets. If you get €1 or £1 out of every 5 wiped out of your wallet by potentially as soon as 2050, then people will definitely feel a difference that will bite harder than inflation. So if people are not worried about their fellow citizens, they'll definitely will think about their own wallets and start acting a bit faster on climate mitigation. Obviously, we all realize that, and scientists already have confirmed worldwide, that our optimistic scenario of lowering emissions to the point that, you know, there won't be any warming whatsoever, and we just sort of pause that for a second, that time has already gone. So within all those scenarios between RCP 2.6 or SSP 2.6 and 8.5, we're going to land somewhere in the middle. But I think the pace of that would be a bit of a stick and a carrot. And the more of these things that we've just seen happen in US, Germany, France, UK, CE region in Europe, the faster we'll start thinking about it. So unfortunately, I think it will be one of those things that we'll get to the point where it won't be too late, but it will be quite painful.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I totally agree with that conclusion. So you are on the forefront, yeah, of a climate change, analytics, software, adaption tech, resilience tech, however we call this segment. And of course, because you're providing data, making sense out of data, etc., potentially you're even enabling others, yeah, to develop their solutions on top of your stack. So how you look at the, let's say, the entrepreneurial environment in Europe, and now also your co-founder just recently relocated to New York City, so you also have, I think, a bit of insights in the US ecosystem. Do you see a lot of fellow entrepreneurs that, I don't know, let's say 10 years ago would just, serial entrepreneurs just set up their next boring B2C e-commerce vertical company, are now venturing in these climate adaption segments? Is that happening?
I think these are still, like, climate risk overall, it's still relatively new. But from startup perspective, I think that time is over. I think climate adaptation itself, it's really new and fascinating, filled with uncertainty sector, which is, you know, something that I guess founders do like and VCs alike. In terms of the popularity of it, I would say it might even grow faster in the States versus Europe, because I think, you know, if you compare the two continents, and that's a personal sentiment, US has been always very much business driven, was, I think, over the past few years, like, EU has been focused on quite a bit of regulation. So I do think that the potential for climate adaptation is kind of happening now, and will be progress. Do I see people changing, working on one thing and moving to the other? I think I've seen a lot of carbon accounting credits and so on startups, and I think the world is full of those at the moment. But I think where I see the future is potentially in nature, biodiversity, and potentially climate adaptation. So yeah, I think these are definitely very exciting areas.
Excellent. So I think we're pretty much done. Do you have any last message you want to give to our listeners?
Thank you so much for listening. If you do have any questions, please reach out and via climatex.com, and I will get back to you.
Excellent. So thanks for your time, and bye-bye.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye.
Key learnings.
Nico, this was our first session. I talked to Henry. You had your discussion. So what do we do out of that?
I think that was spectacularly interesting. Maybe let's summarize a little bit what we learned from these two sessions, shall we?
Yeah, why not? And maybe our listeners can also disprove a little bit or prove our thesis. Maybe my main four takeaways are from my discussion with Henry that, first of all, climate adaptation alone cannot solve climate change. This is one of the questions I actually asked him, whether he sees a risk that once we are focusing more on climate adaptation, that we lose the focus on climate mitigation. And he said, of course, we need to do both. So I think, having said this, this is very important that we don't lose the sight and the focus on both of these aspects. Second, conclusion I would probably draw out of the discussion is that climate adaptation support should prioritize highly vulnerable countries. And these are in particular countries in the global south. Of course, we have climate impacts also in the global north, but the direct consequences, more severe consequences on infrastructure, on resources, etc., are probably in the global south. And I would be very interested to discuss with you later whether this should mean that we only focus on the global south or if we also focus on the global north. The third thesis is that public and private financing is essential for climate adaptation. It will not be enough that the taxpayer is actually paying for all the mess, but we really need to enable private financing. And I think this goes into our overall thesis that we need to leverage technologies and business models to get them into the game of climate adaptation. So we need to have both public and private financing. And maybe the fourth conclusion, which is more or less tied to the last one, is that the responsibility of the private sector is really, really, really growing. So there are a lot of ways, not just on the financing side, but also on the technology side, that the private sector should play its role in climate adaptation. So there were a few other things we discussed and talked about, but these are at least for me the main four takeaways. What did you take away from your discussion?
I think the most interesting thing from my discussion with Camille was that there are already today tools that can give us like a crystal ball of the vulnerable areas and kind of how to, mitigate and adapt to these scenarios. And that's already available right now, right? So I also saw, for example, a quite interesting animation, a short video from them, where they looked at the area in Valencia that was now heavily affected some days before we record this. And the models they have exactly show that vulnerability, that if you have an extreme kind of rain event there, that several areas of the city will get flooded. So the data is there, the knowledge is there. We just need to use it. We need to make sure that when an event like that happens, people are warned in advance. And then, of course, ideally, yeah, if you do a decision as a municipality or as a private investor, you take these vulnerabilities into your consideration. So the data is there, the tools are there, right? Clever startups have developed a lot of solutions. It just has to be used much more, kind of, and potentially not politicized, yeah, to not discuss these things. And I also totally agree with the conclusions you had from your call. We have to get kind of in front of the wave, if you want to say so, because everything else is just so expensive. And therefore, we need a joint effort, yeah, from both public and private investors to invest in the tools that are obviously already there, right? Make sure that there is an environment where clever founders develop more solutions that would help us. And also to conclude with your first point, definitely mitigation and adaptation goes hand in hand.
Sure. So what about the thesis that the most impact currently will be seen in the global south? But on the other hand, of course, most of the money publicly or privately raised will be probably raised in the north. And we both are active in the startup and business and entrepreneurial environment. We both know that it's probably very difficult for a company being based up north to directly unfold a business model somewhere in the global south. So is this maybe something we need to consider, that whatever businesses, entrepreneurs and startups are doing in terms of technologies and business models, that they first will need to scale in our markets, in Europe, in North America, in the global north, and then later go to the global south? Or do you see a way that we really jump directly to the global south?
I think that question has at least two dimensions. So number one is a political or potentially a moral dimension. And I think this is what will be discussed at any COP over the next decade, right? How the global north has to like pay for the climate debt it created, and how to support the global south, that technologies that become more and more available can be financed down there, and how we ensure that it's deployed on the ground, right? So I think this is number one. And a startup alone can't solve that. So the startups can participate in a process like that, but this is really where we need the United Nations and kind of sub-bodies, et cetera, to build the bridges, I think, there and ensure the financing. I think for any startup, it's always a challenge if you start in too many international countries at once. So you will have a domestic market where you can, where it's like an easy thing to start, find the first customers, deploy stuff, and then you will internationalize in the next step. And therefore, I agree that like the social, the moral obligation is to do a lot in the south. But also, again, so just look at what just happened in Spain and elsewhere in Europe. So we have the hazards, we have the effects also here. So therefore, if you want to be like compliant with your thesis, we can already test it here in a commercial case and then roll out later to additional countries, and then hopefully we have the measures, the programs that also support European startups deploying internationally.
Right. Nico, I would say this is a pretty good wrap-up already for our first session here. I would be very interested as well to see what kind of comments our listeners also have. Please contact us. Please tell us what you think about all of this. I think we have laid the foundation and talked about the adaptation, climate adaptation basics. I'm very much looking forward to our next session, which will be in about a month, where we talk about one of the aspects in much more detail. this will be the water part. So yeah, looking forward to that. I already have a very good and exciting guest, which we will reveal a little later. So looking forward to our next discussion, Nico.
Absolutely, my pleasure. So looking forward to everything that comes down the pipe.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to Heat Beyond 1.5. We hope you'll join us again next time. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and share the podcast to help us spread the word. This podcast is produced by PT1 and DWR Eco. For more information, visit www.heat.vc.